Hi, this is Favi Fav, and today it's just me. Sorry. I know, it's our off week. What am I doing? It's our off week. Favi, take a break. I wish I could, but, you know, during this pandemic, doing this podcast and my other podcast, the Art People podcast, is a treat for me. And I'm going to bring you an episode that I did for the Art People podcast a few weeks ago with director Kareem Tabsh. Now, if you haven't watched the Walter Mercado documentary, Mucho, Mucho Amor, The Legend of Walter Mercado, currently on Netflix, push pause right now. Go check it out because we're going to be talking about that doc. We're also going to be talking about his other films, The Last Resort, that's on Netflix as well, Dolphin Lover, I think that's on YouTube, and Cherry Pop, that one's on Amazon. So go check those out and then come right back. I hope you enjoy this special episode of Latinos Who Lunch again with the one and only Kareem Tabsh. Enjoy. Hi, I'm Justin Favela, and this is the Art People Podcast. It's the podcast about art, people. Get it? Okay. On this show, I bring you the conversations I have with art people in my hometown of Las Vegas and the folks I get to meet on my travels around the world. This week, I'm joined by documentary filmmaker and arts advocate Kareem Tabsh. Listen in as I chat with Kareem about growing up in Miami, his love for old cinema, and of course, his amazing documentary films. From Cherry Pop to Mucho, Mucho Amor, The Legend of Walter Mercado, we discuss Kareem's fascination with the colorful characters of South Florida, his connection to past and present generations through storytelling, and his love for the kitschy and fabulous. The Abuelita vibes are strong with this one.
Hey there.
All right. Sounds great.
Awesome.
Oh my gosh. I don't even know where to start. I am such a big fan. I just rewatched the Walter Mercado documentary last night. And I loved it once again.
Thanks for watching it.
I'm so excited to talk about your films because there's something in them that I just relate to so much. And I think it's because of your inspiration and what you used to watch when you were a kid. I have a feeling that you are a very nostalgic person, and that
I'm totally a vieja. I probably have more in common like with abuelitas than with my contemporaries in many ways. So I think you've hit the nail right on the head.
Yo, the abuelita vibes are strong, and I live.
They don't make good batas in my size, but other than that. It's total abuelita vibe here.
Oh my God. The last time I went to Mexico, I was looking for that perfect abuelita mumu, you know, the perfect bata. And I could not, I don't know where my grandma sources them. It's so hard.
Abuela chic. It's definitely the thing that's going to be coming back. I mean, if the 80s and the 90s are making fashion returns, abuela chic is like our next big Latino takeover.
Exactly. They already appropriated the chola, okay? Thank you.
That's right.
Yeah, thank you so much to all the white ladies. Rosalia, you too. But, you know, like, that's the only thing we got left. Okay. Well, let's get into your background a little bit. I know that you're in Miami. Were you born and raised in Miami?
Yeah. I'm one of the few natives left, I feel like.
You know, I feel like I'm from Las Vegas, and there's so many similarities, and I feel like people from Miami that are born and raised there, it's just like Las Vegas. I was like, yep, I was born and raised in Las Vegas. It's like such a badge of honor, you know, because this is like such a transient town, and nobody kind of sticks around, you know?
Yeah, totally. It's the same. I mean, obviously, it's the same here. I mean, that's certainly changed in recent years. But yeah, I mean, it is one of the things of living in a place like this is that, you know, it's always changing and like your environment in your community is always changing because it's so different. So many, a lot of people don't stick around, you know?
Yeah, and I know you have Lebanese and Cuban parents, correct?
That's right. My dad was from Lebanon, my mom from Cuba, which I always say means good food and bad tempers. But I promise I only got the best parts from both of them.
So how was it growing up with those parents and you probably, you know, showing that you had signs of wanting to be an artist from such a young age? Because I know for me, that didn't go too well.
Yeah. I mean, you know, listen, it's funny because, you know, being also being first generation American, right? Like the child of immigrants. And my mom came in her late teens. I think she was 16. And my dad came at like 20 or 22, something like that. So I came relatively young. But still, you know, they're immigrants, you know, regardless of how old they were when they came. So, and the goal was like, no, we're going to go through all the shit we went through so that you become a doctor or a lawyer. So which one is it going to be? You know? So for a long time, I thought I was going to be a doctor, and I'm still fascinated with medicine, and I was then. But I always really kind of wanted a life in the arts and from a young age. But that, yeah, that did not necessarily fit well, you know, the idea of like artists being a career that you could pay the bills with or live off of or prosper, because there's also that pressure, right? Like, we're doing this, we're going through hard times so that you're going to have better times, which is real. And but that's, yeah, that's a struggle. So in many ways, you know, it was just not something that was on my radar. And I had the added pressure that I would say as a kid, I was the good one. So I'm the middle of three boys. Mm-hmm. And my older brother growing up was kind of, he was like the jock and the badass and always getting in some sort of trouble. And my younger brother was, you know, relatively quiet for a long time and then stopped being quiet. And and so he was a little more introverted. So, you know. I was a more vocal kid, and I was, you know, I was smart, and they think they really kind of put the hopes that I was going to be, you know, I was going to be the one that went on to become whatever, a doctor or a lawyer. I always love to flash forward and say that both of my brothers have master degrees, and I am a college dropout in the arts. So my parents not so good with the gambles. So it wasn't an easy path of wanting to be an artist, and it kind of took a while to get there, and I think that's why I really kind of came into my stride, you know, much later than so many other people, because it wasn't necessarily a path that was encouraged.
Yeah, I wonder a lot too, because I know, like, with queer kids like myself, for example, I was also the good kid growing up. And a lot of times I wonder, was it because I was just trying to kind of fly under the radar so I wouldn't be interrogated about, like, why I didn't like boy stuff, you know? I don't know. Like, I think I have a lot of friends, too, that were, like, you know, the good queer kid. I mean, they weren't out, obviously, when they were kids, but it was, like, you know, their brothers kind of fit into those stereotypical roles, and then we kind of just... I feel like I kind of just had to figure it out. So my escape and the way that I did that was like hanging out with my grandmas. You know, that was a safe space. And then also like watching TV, PBS, cooking shows, talk shows. Like that was my shit, you know. And now I think back and I'm like, oh, that's what really inspired my art. Do you have moments like that? You could think back to your childhood where you're like, this is when I knew that I wanted to be a filmmaker.
You know, it's funny that you say that, just because there's definitely a simpatico as we chat, in our experiences, because, you know, I was, as a kid, I mean, I always felt different. I don't think that's a very unique story when you're a queer kid. You know that you are unlike most of the people around you. And my differences wasn't just that I was attracted to other boys when I finally figured out that that's what it was. Mm-hmm. But I also just kind of, I don't want to say I rejected like mainstream pop culture, but I just didn't feel the same connection to it.
that I did with other more obscure things relative to my age. So, like, I mean, I'm a PBS junkie still, but I certainly was one as a kid. And as a kid in particular, I mean, I remember watching something that was called The Movies at 2. And every afternoon at 2 o'clock, an old movie would be played on the local PBS station. And on days of early school release or in the summer, I was able to catch those kind of in their entirety. And they were these, you know, for a 10 or 12-year-old or 13-year-old boy, these like obscure black and white movies. I mean, obviously, in retrospect, I know that I saw things like Casablanca and, you know, Maltese Falcon and stuff like that. But at the time, it was just so different. And you didn't, you know, it was kind of a different world. And now all of my contemporaries were watching A Different World. And not to say that I didn't watch that sometimes too, or Living Single or whatever was of the time. But I was also like really getting into these weird movies that I saw on PBS that felt like they transported me to a different time, or British comedies. I mean, I adored and still do the, you know, like Britcoms, which I would see every evening. And I had this weird fascination with like music of a different era. And so in many ways that kind of helped inform, you know, kind of both my aesthetic and my view of the world. I was always kind of curious on that path less taken. So, you know, I couldn't talk to my friends for the most part about like, you know, Frank Sinatra or Liza Minnelli or, you know, Are You Being Served?
Oh my gosh. I love, you know, that
show. Those weren't things that anybody understood. So it was just kind of yet another way that I was different. I wasn't interested in sports though. I was really pushed to play them when I was in like middle school. I played football and I have a foot. I'm very proud to say I have a football injury in middle school. And like, I hated every fucking moment of it.
Oh man.
But all of that stuff kind of, you know, it definitely helped inform and shape who I am and that kind of old soul vibe that I have always felt.
I get a sense of that, like I said, when I watch your films, and I want to jump right into it, to two short films that I watched that you did, one called The Dolphin Lover and one called Cherry Pop.
Yeah.
Both about animals, but in a very completely different way.
Very different animal stories.
But what I did notice there was I just felt familiar with the film right away. I don't know if it was the colors, the transitions, the use of old photographs I saw in both films. It immediately took me to the days where, you know, like watching Mr. Rogers, watch Miss Picture, right? So it's like, yeah, it's a film about something that's referencing something else that has this aesthetic and reverence to it, right? So even though they're kind of uncomfortable subjects, like, okay, let's get into The Dolphin Lover, like a man and a dolphin that, according to the gentleman, the dolphin also fell in love with him, you know? So...
Right.
You are capturing these stories from Florida that are so fucking weird. but also it's like, yeah, that's Florida.
Yeah, totally. Totally. You know, it's so funny. I've always leaned into that kind of like the weird fucked up craziness of Florida. So yeah. Many people are always like lamenting it or criticizing it or making fun of it. And I'm like, fuck it. We should be celebrating it. Like, yeah, it's a weird fucking place. You know, you're not going to confuse Florida with, you know, New Hampshire at any point. And thank God for that. I mean, like, you know, and not just, you know, I mean, also I think it's kind of part of like being here. And Lord knows there's a lot of, you know, weird fucked up parts about the state that drive me nuts. But I think moreover, it's just like, what I love about these stories, and I realize that just kind of it's really inspired and informed my filmmaking, is that, you know, I'm interested in kind of people who are brazen enough to live on the edge of societies without any trepidation, like people who are brave enough to be themselves despite knowing that the world can be a cruel and critical place. And it doesn't necessarily mean that I have to agree with them, but there's something to that, to being this authentic version of yourself that is incredibly inspiring, I think, and fascinating. And I mean, for what, you know, I think maybe, you know, Florida is just one part city and one part swampland still in many ways. So I think we have a, you know, a pretty high ratio of these kind of interesting characters. That kind of those types of lives really, really fascinate me. And that's kind of what, you know, drew me, my inspiration to both of those. Cherry Pop is like, you know, which is my first short film, is with a much more personal story, because I grew up knowing Cherry Pop and her owners.
No way. You knew those people?
I knew those people. My mom for like 25 years or 20 years was a purebred Persian and Himalayan cats. I grew up in like this, in the crazy animal world. She also published a pet magazine. The funny thing about the cats is that even though she bred cats for 20 or 25 years and had like her cattery at home, I was the only one of her three children who were not allergic to cats. which is, you know, nutty in and of itself. But so I grew up in that world, and I remember seeing Cherry Pop and her owners and knowing them a little bit as a kid. And it just kind of, you know, when you see this like super pampered cat, we grew up in a very, you know, poor working class neighborhood in Miami. But when you saw these kind of really wealthy people, this super pampered cat, like unlike anything you had ever seen, that shit stays in your memory. It's in a similar way kind of to Walter Mercado, actually. It's like one of those things that when it happens when you're young, you never forget. And Dolphin Lover is different because I discovered that story as an adult. But it was just such a crazy story that, and I knew it would make for a really great, great film.
Yeah. Okay. I got a couple questions about this, the cattery in your house. How many cats were in your house at one time?
Oh man. You know, that is a really good question that I don't have a very good memory of. Okay. I would say there's anywhere between maybe at the peak 40 cats.
Oh my God.
On average, maybe like 20 or 25. I should say that my mother would probably be very upset if I didn't point out that the cattery was a separate room in the house. Mm-hmm. It's like a large room that was built for the cattery. So they expanded it. So the cats were not loose all over the house because of my brothers and their allergies. All of the cats lived in this room. Most of them were in cages for at least part of the day. It was crazy. In what is, however, what I feel like a very kind of Latino experience, at one point, as a young kid, my younger brother and I shared a room upstairs, and eventually my older brother moved out and I moved downstairs into his room. So the cattery was actually built kind of like off of the kitchen. It was built into part of the yard, and one of the walls that it butted was my room. But in order to keep the cost down or to not pull permits, they never replaced the glass window. There's an entire wall in that room that was like a double sliding door window that looked right into the cattery. So if the shades are open, all of the cats would be looking into my room at any given point. The shades are almost never open. And although when I was bored, it would be funny to just look at the cats and see what the hell they were doing. But this is to give you a little, it was just it's just one of those weird growing up things that you take for granted until you think about it. Now you're like, God, that was weird.
Yeah, you just think it's a normal thing. Oh my gosh.
I kind of knew it wasn't normal. Yeah. But I think how weird it was has only reiterated itself to me now as an adult.
So weird. I can't imagine. My roommates have 3 cats and I feel like I'm in a cattery, but 40 right. cats, Jesus. Okay, another question about Cherry Pop. I was wondering, were those people already wealthy before the cat, or did the cat make them wealthy?
No, so they were already wealthy.
That's what I thought. Okay.
So basically, they became wealthy. I don't know. I mean, we talk about it in the film kind of relative. You know, we don't go into great detail, but the way they really became wealthy is that Huey and Vi. Huey had started, he got into the dry cleaning business.
pretty early on after the war in New Jersey, and when they relocated to Fort Lauderdale, he continued in that business, which with specialization of commercial dry cleaning. So he was handling the dry cleaning for like hotels and restaurants, which obviously in the tourist big cities like Fort Lauderdale, Miami, was pretty lucrative. So that's how they made their money.
That makes sense. I'm like, damn, this cat got a private jet. I don't. What kind of shows are they winning?
No, you know, the money. The cat never made them money. really, the cat just cost them money.
Wow,
which was the fascinating thing. I mean, because they would go through these really elaborate, you know, all the things that they did with the cat and traveling for the shows. And the big events and birthdays they threw for the cat. I mean, all of that cost them money. But to their credit, I will say that they also used it as a way of, like, raising funds for, like, Humane Society and ASPCA and stuff like that. But, that cat was living high on the hog at their... at their expense.
Oh, my gosh. I bet just having your mother... have that business gave you really a window into a whole nother world of like the people that collect those kind of cats, you know?
Oh yeah. I mean, so my mom, I mean, she bred the cats and she also showed them. She was like in the whole cat show world, which is very different than like the dog show world. Like now I think it's changed a bit, but back then the cats really didn't, it was like a cat beauty pageant. They didn't have to like jump through hoops or anything. You know, they were just judged on which one was, you know, prettiest according to like the standard. And those people, I mean, you know, not with any sense of judgment, those people were really fucking weird. I mean, I know that I'm judging it. I sound judgmental. I love them with weird. I miss those times because it was such a weird world to be in. So uncommon for everybody else. But yeah, it was like a very peculiar, it was a very peculiar scenario to grow up upon, like grow in like, it was weird. And I went with my mom most of the time because, again, my older brother was just too old for it when my mom started. Like, he was, you know, in his late teens, early 20s, I think, when she started. There was an 8-year difference between him and I, and then 2 years between my younger brother and I. So my younger brother sometimes got dragged along too, but I was the one who always had to go because I wasn't allergic to the cats and she, you know, needed help. But it, you know, it really was a great front row seat to like study human nature.
Yeah.
And I was a pretty observant kid and I would just notice these things about the people in this world and, you know, how there's these microcosms of communities around a hobby or an interest. So it was really, I think it was really, really fascinating for me. And in a way kind of helpful, like for knowing people, cause this was kind of a prime example of how of different people, like people in a particular interest group, but how like the same traits that we see, whether it's jealousy, competitiveness, compassion, empathy, kindness, ruthlessness, all kind of congregated in one world, and I kind of got a front row seat to it. Yeah.
Is that where you kind of developed an interest in older folks? I'm going to jump into The Last Resort. Speaking of characters and, you know, really, I don't want to say subculture, but like it's that documentary. So this documentary, The Last Resort, is about Miami Beach and how it went basically from... you know, the military using it for training to a destination for Jewish people to retire. And then in the 80s, you know, I'm not going to tell the whole documentary, but it's like this, it was, I saw this continuation or this really love for abuelitas in this film, you know? And so I wonder if that's kind of where it came from.
You know, I think to a certain extent it did because, being somebody who felt so different as a young person, I didn't always feel like super connected to like people my age, because I was so different and being my interests, being queer, being like the fat kid, all those things kind of separate you further. And so I spent a lot of times around adults, and I would go with my mom to these cat shows, and, you know, they were throughout Florida mostly. I think she traveled out of the state a couple of times, but we would go, and there's very few kids there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was like spending 2 days in, you know, in your weekend time, surrounded by adults, but also all the things that I was interested in were of people much, much older than I, right? Like these old black and white movies, these British sitcoms from the 70s and 80s, this music. So I think that, you know, all of that kind of contributed to my interest in people who are older than I. I always felt more mature than kind of people around me. And I mean, I don't know how true that was now in retrospect, but I definitely felt older. And I was actually kind of in my group of friends, always was kind of the older one too. Not by a lot, but by enough to make a bit of a difference. So, yeah, I think that that kind of, you know, I think that that was kind of what drew the affinity to me. But, you know, in the last resort, mm-hmm. I think that the other thing is that, you know, like in Cherry Proper, like in Dolphin Lover, which is, you know, a whole of the story we're talking about. But like, you know, these are people who are out there. And so these viejitos, these abuelitas were like living their best life, dressing however the fuck they wanted. And, it, you know, in a way, it was such a contrast to like my abuela, which I think it also is both cultural and maybe just from a, you know, where she came from. But like my grandparents did not socialize. Like the majority of people who visited, there was like a handful of friends from the neighborhood who they would see on a semi-regular basis. And then it was like family. The idea of like, but my grandparents didn't go out to the movies. They didn't go out to the theater. I think part of it was a class thing. So the idea that here is this universe, and that was, you know, that was my experience in a lot of ways of older people. It was like, oh, you're that's it. Your life is quote unquote done. So here to see this, and my experience of that personally was very different because I had a lot of friends who were in their 70s. One of my closest friends is, he killed me to say, and I won't say his name, but one of my closest friends is 71. So, you know, I was a different experience. So in this world that we discovered through these photographs of Andy Sweet and Gary Monroe, you had this culture that was celebrating. They were living their best life. They were dressing these bold patterns. I mean, very kind of the day in the 70s, 60s, and 70s, right? Like they were fashionable. They were social. They were doing things. Miami Beach at that point, like when our film first starts talking about it in the 70s, there was Yiddish theater, there was radio stations, there was shows, there was movies, but there was also dances every week, twice a week. There were social dances that are full of these viejitos, these like abuelitas y abuelos. There were romances. Like there is all mm-hmm. of this stuff. And I think I loved that, that like here's this, you know, this is a population that we've always kind of like, I don't want to say looked down upon, but we always, you know, we're forgotten. Like we so often ignore older people still. And here are these people who were definitely ignored and living on their own, but made the best of their lives. And they had hard lives. And most of them weren't rich. In fact, most of them were working class people who were who were maybe seamstresses or working as policemen or postmen. I mean, these were not people who had a lot of, you know, came from a lot of resources, but they were making the best of their life. And so that really appealed to me too, this idea, you know, of like really enjoying life despite, you know, whatever your circumstances were. And so that appealed to me as well a great deal.
Yeah, and I also love it was started by all these old Jewish people, you know, loving Art Deco, just wanting to have nice, soft pastel colors to look at, you know? Right. And it just became this like iconic destination after them, but also because of them, you know? Right. And it goes back to like my podcast, Latinos Who Lunch. Like the reason why we call it that is because it's based on the term ladies who lunch. Which is based on, you know, the ladies in New York, you know, that would collect art and were the tastemakers, you know, back in the day. There were, you know, they were the ones that started to fill these museums with impressionist art and really starting to you start these cultural institutions, basically. And so it's like, it's almost the same thing happening in Miami where these, you know, old Jewish women, they know what they like. They're gonna have it built, and then people appreciate that architecture and that art form because they love it so much, you know. It's so interesting to see kind of those parallels in different places of the United States, but in very different ways, you know.
Totally. And the other interesting thing to me is that this is a place where they were actively unwelcomed for mm-hmm. such a long time, because Miami Beach was restricted. You see it in our film. You see the old ads that say Gentile clientels only. You know, there were signs that said no Jews allowed in some places. Jews weren't allowed to own property in many places. So here you have this population that had been, you know, shit on and discriminated against, who were actively able to work against that, and in those systems created their own communities, resources, right? Created mm-hmm. their own banks, created their own business and civic organizations, and transformed this community. And then you saw it again in Miami Beach with the queer community. Like, the renaissance of the late 80s and early 90s was largely due, I mean, obviously there's a lot of people involved, but a lot of it was led by like a queer community who found paradise in South Beach and, you know, created their version of it. And obviously, you know, everything changes, and like every iteration of something is going to be different. And some things are laid to the wayside, and, you know, it's unfortunate that, you know, the shifts that happened. But if you think, you know, I love that part of it too. Like, here are these people who were really kind of like looked down upon and who turned that around. I mean, we see it in this country with the African American community. I mean, Black people and Latinos who have been challenged at every notion and face, you know, relentless bigotry and racism, and who still manage to thrive in their own way and in their own communities. So that to me is the other aspect of that that's really kind of fascinating and admirable.
Yeah, I also like that the film was like a documentary in a documentary, which was cool. It was really about these artists too that were documenting this time in history, because even then they knew that it was special, you know, and the continuation of that documentation even afterwards, you know, which is really cool.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that that's, you know, I connected a lot with them mm-hmm. as subjects, because it was not unlike, right, like my experience. I mean, here are these young guys in their 20s documenting this community of people that were their grandparents' age or older. And so it was like, in my making the film, you know, here I am in my mid to late 30s at the point when we started making the film. And it's probably not the film that you'd expect to come out of a 30-something-year-old, although I'll say that my co-director, Dennis, is in his early 60s now. So there's a certainly age difference, but he's still, I mean, you know, there's a difference there. And I think that that kind of, like, the way they were so fascinated with that community was something that fascinated me too. And their work is so beautiful. I mean, I started by falling in love with the photography of Andy Sweet in particular, because I really responded to those bright colors, but I adore Gary Monroe's photos too.
Yeah.
So I started there and ended up falling in love with the subjects of their photographs, like they did. So I think there's something kind of wonderful about that, that in that way, my journey was similar to theirs.
Yeah, yeah. It really did celebrate their art, and it was so nice to be able to capture that for both artists, you know, just to have something to, you know, to leave a little legacy there, which is so nice. And speaking of legacy, my God, the legend of Walter Mercado, I can't imagine. I mean, just spending time in Walter Mercado's home, like, I was just watching this documentary, flipping out, thinking, like, if I was in the shoes of the directors, you know, like, I would be so overwhelmed. But, okay, I jumped ahead because I'm getting so excited. But can you tell me how that happened? How long have you been thinking about Walter Mercado and making a documentary about this being?
You know, Walter, I grew up with Walter, like so many of us who are Latino. He was just a daily presence. So, I was, the way it kind of came to be is that I was in the middle of finishing The Last Resort, and I was in New York, and my friend Andrew Evia, who's one of the producers of Moonlight, a very dear friend, said, "You know, you have to meet my buddy Alex Fumero. Alex is from Miami. He lives in New York. He's at the time Alex was a VP at HBO." He's like, "You guys are going to get along super well. You should connect." And so Alex and I met for a coffee at Bryant Park and just were kind of shooting the shit and getting to know each other. He's such a great guy. He's really, really funny and super smart. And, you know, he said, what do you have going on next? And I said, "Well, when I go back to Miami, one of the things I'm looking forward to is I am going to Walter Mercado's estate sale. I wanna see if I buy myself a cape or something." And we had a good laugh, and he said, "You know, gosh, if there's anyone I could do a documentary about, it would be Walter Mercado." And, you know, and I said, "Well, you know, I'm going to be chismoso and see what is in Walter Mercado's estate sale, but I am also going with the goal of trying to contact Walter's family because I also wanna kind of navigate those waters of what a documentary would be." And he said, "Look, if there's anything I can do to help you, let me know. Consider it done." And so I went to the estate sale. I met one of Walter's nieces, Danette. I bought some tchotchkes. And then I gave her the very quick introduction of who I am, what I was interested in. She's like, "Oh, well, let's talk." I went back 2 days after that. On a Sunday, which I always say is when you know that's it, when the end of the sales, when you get the real good deals. I also went to chat her to her more, and I did. And I gave her the pitch of what I was looking and interested in, and she said, "Look, I think Walter might be interested in this. Here's my business card. Send me an email. I'll share it with Walter and with Walter's team and my sisters, and let's go from there." And so I did that. I took the card, rather. And then Alex and I had a debrief call scheduled, or it was going to be our first production call for the documentary. Now it's all how it went. And half an hour before that call, Alex got a phone call from Cristina Costantini. Uh-huh. Alex and Cristina had worked together at Fusion, and she was just finishing a movie called Science Fair, which is brilliant. And she said, "Hey, I hear you're obsessed with Walter Mercado. So am I. I want to make a documentary about him." And he said, "You're not going to believe this. I'm already making a documentary about him. I have a call in half an hour with the director, but I think you guys would get along. Why don't I see if he's down for you joining the call?" And that's exactly what happened. Alex texted me and said, "Look, I know this woman, Christina. She's amazing. I think you'd love her. She's interested in making something with Walter. Maybe there's a collaboration there." And, you know, a 45-minute phone call later, we both decided we're going to do it together. Even though we had never met in person or knew each other, we just kind of got all the right vibes from one another. And that's how we decided that we were going to do it. And that was the start of a 3-year journey in telling and making the film and sharing it with the world.
I mean, you could almost say the stars aligned.
Walter would say, according to the stars, it was perfect.
And so, that's the end of the show. Thank you, everybody.
Don't forget to tip your waiter. It was a touch of kismet.
So my relationship with Walter is very interesting because, I mean, I grew up watching Univision, Telemundo, and I grew up in a very strict, my Guatemalan side is evangelical Christian. So when Walter was on TV, my grandma would actually turn it off because that was, you know, ese Walter, el demonio. So, but on my Catholic side, on my grandma's side, she would leave it on and she would pay attention. And I would observe that. And it was also this forbidden thing at my Guatemalan side of the family. So I would really pay attention to what Walter was saying and, you know, kind of taking mental notes, but not really saying anything. And then when I, you know, as an elder millennial, I
love that term.
Yes. I'm like, because I still remember the world without internet. So I feel like,
okay.
But I'm not quite. Okay. So, so I see that. I think you mentioned it in the documentary, like millennials really go up for Walter Mercado, because if you think about all the woo-woo shit that we're into, like crystals and, of course, astrology. But, you know, there's all this talk about energy nowadays that, you know, back in the day, that was only reserved for, like, Santeria and for, like, you know, California, you know, hippies, you know, kind of thing.
Right, exactly.
But I'm curious to know, like, what your relationship growing up watching Walter was.
You know, so the interesting thing is that while my grandmother watched and he was like this constant presence in the house, I couldn't tell you that there was, I don't know how much reverence there was around him, but I think that there is a healthy sense of both hopeful skepticism. Like, my grandmother was not super religious, Catholic, but, you know, I think that there was a sense of, like, I hope he's right, or let's see what he does. There's also this por si acaso, you know, in case he's right, I should pay attention, you know? Mm-hmm. I describe it like an like the world's best insurance policy. Like, you know, I don't know, but just in the event...
I remember there was a time where he was giving advice on, like, what to put in your baths. And I remember my grandma was, like, super into that. Like, make sure you put a little bit of lavender and salt, you know. And that was like, okay, this is like rancho shit that I know about. So I'm going to I'm gonna really pay attention.
That was part of his annual thing, el baño de final de año.
Oh, my gosh. Was, yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it was such a thing. It was such a thing. But so, like, for me, seeing him, you know, as a kid, like, what I also realized is, like, I recognized that he was different. Like, you had never seen anybody like Walter Mercado before. Nobody looked like that, dressed like that, sounded like that, talked about that stuff. So I think that I recognized that difference. And, like, maybe I didn't you know, I don't know that I realized that I was queer then.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that he was different. And I knew he was different in a way that I was different. I like to say now that, you know, Walter Mercado looked the way I felt. And so seeing him, and he was seemingly very successful, seemingly, you know, rich and popular and confident and happy, and more importantly, beloved, right? Like, my family loved him. Our culture loved him. Being who he was, so different. So I think for me, you know, when I saw that and I realized this, Walter Mercado being who he was, different, in a way that I was different, if he was so loved and so popular and adored by my family, then maybe I too could be loved. Mm. And I think that that was, you know, incredibly reaffirming. It's, you know, that's when you see these things as a young person, they mean so much to you and they really can mark the journey of your life. And I think that that was the case for me. And that's, you know, when my fascination with Walter began, I think, because he was an inspirational figure, not just in what he said that made our family and our culture feel hopeful, but in what he personally represented for me. And I should add that I am not a believer. I do not I don't believe in shit, you know, but I believe in Walter. You know, I believe in Walter's ability to make people feel special and feel loved. And I believe in his message. It's almost inconsequential to me whether he could see the future or the stars, whether any of that is, you know, even after spending that time with him, I can't tell you that I take any, you know, astrology particularly seriously, or not any more seriously than I take any organized religion, which tells you not very seriously at all. I do believe in, you know, I believe in his message, which is one of love and hope and peace. And that was the most important thing for me.
Yeah, it reminds me of that scene in the movie where Jorge Ramos is interviewing him. And Walter even says, even though he doesn't believe in God, God, you know, like, and then he goes on with this spiel. Oh, so good. Okay, I'm not going to lie to you. I was actually a little bit afraid of watching the movie because I have, just to give you a little background, I used to work for the Liberace Foundation here in Las Vegas.
And, oh, my God.
Similar to you.
This is going to turn into a completely different conversation in 2 seconds. Just so you know. But go on.
Girl, let me tell you. Just so you know, a very kind of similar story. I mean, I didn't make a documentary, but the Liberace Foundation, the museum closed many years ago here in Vegas.
Yeah.
And we were all like, oh my God, that was the best place in town. And one of my friends was the collections manager there, and she was archiving everything and making sure all the costumes were stored properly and this and that. And at the time I was in school, I was in art school, and I'm like, I gotta see this stuff. I just want the chance to just be near or you know, even just help pack one of his capes or something, you know? And so I went to the Liberace Museum and I started volunteering. So I would go twice a week for many, many weeks and help archive his music. And eventually I was trusted enough to handle his costumes and we would kind of make these they were weird box. They were like, you know, archival boxes without acid, but we would have to make these almost like paper bodies to like put the suits around so they didn't fold. It was a lot of work, but it was incredible just being near all of those artifacts. And when I saw Walter Mercado's house, that's exactly how Liberace also lived, which just kind of like blew my mind that it was almost the exact same aesthetic. I think Liberace's was a little more Catholic heavy than Walter's. But all that to say is that, you know, there was that Behind the Candelabra movie that came out.
Yes.
And yes. I know a lot of Liberace lovers were really bummed out about it because it didn't put him in the best light, you know? And there isn't really a big Liberace documentary out there that, you know, I think that also shows Liberace. So it was like the only way that he kind of has been portrayed in a big way recently in Hollywood. And so when I was first going to watch the Walter Mercado documentary, I was like, oh my gosh, I hope I don't get so bummed out by watching this like the other thing, you know? And oh my God, it was the complete opposite. Watching the film, who knew that Walter Mercado was a damn comedian? He is so funny.
I know.
And I just couldn't, I was just so pleasantly surprised. I just loved it. I loved being in his home. I mean, the reverence that y'all had for him. It was just so beautiful. But the jokes.
Thank you.
He came in with the jokes. It was so good.
He was one of the funniest people and smartest people I have ever met.
Yeah.
And I think it's surprising. I think of so many of us, myself included, like all of us at first glance, like le tirábamos de menos.
Mm-hmm.
A Walter Mercado. We took him for granted and we kind of shrugged him off as this silly campy thing, but there was layers there. I mean, he was brilliant. First of all, I feel like we never even talk about it so much. He could talk to you about anything, world history, religions, all religions, history, culture, opera, movies. He was a huge film buff. Him and I talked movies all the time. He would send me movies. But also, I mean, politics, sexuality, but yeah, the other part that, you know, you get a little taste of when you saw him on TV, but not really, was his incredible sense of humor and his recognition of himself. Like, he was in on his own joke. He never took himself – he took what he did very seriously. But he never took himself so seriously that he couldn't laugh and enjoy the kind of, you know, what he would call them stupid little things. And that is, you know, that's kind of one of the most joyful things of making the film was just getting time to spend with him. The other brilliant thing about him was that he used humor and his charm to did not want to talk about.
So deflect.
He had us laughing off our asses every day. But anytime something really difficult came up, and you kind of see it in the film a couple of times, he makes a joke here or there. And it's a really kind of it's a great way to kind of like throw you off. And sometimes he was very successful with it. You know, it's funny that you say that about Liberace, which I am also pretty obsessed with. I have this, you must have seen this book. I have this book, which is a book of just photos of his costumes.
Liberace Extravaganza. Yes.
Liberace Extravaganza.
I have it.
It is in my, it used to be on my coffee table. It is now in my guest room, so my guests can enjoy it. Yes. And I will say, I don't know how public this is. I know that there's people who are working, trying to get a Liberace doc off the ground.
Oh,
and there are people who I really respect and love. So I hope that happens. Yes. But, you know, I think that, you know, we jokingly always called him the Latino Liberace.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's certainly a lot of similarities. But, you know, I think you probably know that that image of Liberace with the capes and the extravagant, I mean, that really kind of came later in his career. You know, in those early days, he was in the tuxedos and, you know, kind of safer. And Walter was kind of from day one, always kind of over the top and extra. And I mean, similarly, both of them neither talked about their sexuality in a direct way. Walter certainly didn't with us on or off camera. And Lord knows I tried. I always feel like the other thing about Walter is that he may have not talked about it, but from the first day that he appeared on television as Walter Mercado, like not as an actor, he showed us who he was and he embraced it. And like, he was authentic and himself. And that's not to say he's not complicated and that there's other parts of his life and career that if he had to do over, maybe he would have or might not be as proud of in retrospect. But he was really always true to himself. And I think that that was incredibly validating for those of us who saw him. And he was just a lovely human being. I mean, warts and all, right? Like we all make mistakes, warts and all. He was just a wonderful, wonderful person. And this kind of wonderful figure for Latino culture. I mean, you know, the only other person who kind of like, we think of Juan Gabriel a lot
as far as
somebody who was like queer presenting, you know, or in that sense, even though maybe never came out. And that, you know, in Latino culture, that there's something to be said about that. And Walter started, you know, Walter appeared on TV looking like Walter in 1969.
Wow.
So, you know, that's, think about that.
Yeah, I think that's the Holy Trinity for me. It's Walter, Juanga, and Liberace. You know, and
I love that.
Yeah, that for me, they are. That's it. I mean, that's
yeah.
And I feel like they all kind of inspired each other at one point, and you know, knew about each other. I mean, they're very different ages, but it's still. I mean, we still don't know how old Walter Mercado is. He's eternal now, but I love. What did he say? From 50 to death. What is
entre 50 y la muerte. You know, here's a fun fact: is Walter did meet Liberace. You couldn't help but ask about. Couldn't help but ask about it because the comparisons have always been made. And Walter, I will say that Walter did not like those comparisons. He actually found he did say he found Liberace to be a person who was very sad inside. And I think that that's something we've heard from other people too. But they did. They met in Puerto Rico. They met in Puerto Rico at a nightclub through mutual friends. He shared that story. I mean, there's not a place for it in the movie, which is
right. When
you spend, you know, we shot with Walter for 2 years. So there was tons of stories that didn't make it. And, you know, when you live such a fabulous life, you meet everyone. For sure he met Liberace sometime in the 70s. I want to say it was 70s or maybe late 70s, early 80s in Puerto Rico.
Oh my God. Well, I don't want to give away too much of the movie because I know all of our listeners, if they haven't already seen it, come on, get your life together. But
what are you doing?
What are you, what? Excuse me?
Yeah, exactly. What, like, if you have to choose, I guarantee you, like, skip the episode of Real Housewives or whatever the hell you're watching. Walter is going to be much more entertaining. And that has even less to do with us than the fact that he's just wonderful all in and of himself.
Walter was the only housewife, okay? So,
right.
But wait, going back to what you said, there's a lot that was kind of left on the cutting room floor. And I think I heard an interview with you and your collaborators on the film about some stuff that you wish you would have left or like could have fit in the film. I know that, you know, there's this big celebration in the movie where a lot of people go to a museum to celebrate Walter. And I know that there was a lot of chaos that happened that night that you said you had to kind of cut out of the film. Were there any other moments like that that you wish you that you want people to know that happened?
Oh, gosh. There was always a lot of chaos in one way or another. Let me say that. There's a lot that didn't make it into the film, but yeah. That thankfully has – some of it has started coming out on, like, social media. So if you follow the Netflix Con Todo or Prism – I'm sorry, not Prism. Netflix Con Todo or Most – which are their like Latino-centric and LGBT-centric social media accounts, mm-hmm. You'll come across some of the cutting room stuff. Like there's a great moment where we follow Walter to like this Ayurvedic store in Old San Juan where he's friends with the owner of like 40 plus years. And he asks, you know, we film him asking the guy if he has any cannabis. He goes, do you have any cannabis? He goes, I have CBD. And Walter's like, oh, CBD. And we're like, wait, Walter, do you smoke pot? He's like, I try once. The doctor told me I try once, but nothing. And then he pauses. He goes, not like acid, which I love. And we're like, wait, what? And he tells us this story of how he's like, I did several experiments. And I had very beautiful trips. And we're like, our mind was blown. We loved that story. Our mind was blown. When it came out, I was obsessed with the docuseries Wild Wild Country.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, me too.
I mean, obsessed.
Yes. And, Sheila?
Oh. Sheila, exactly.
Tough titties.
Well,
anyway.
Tough titties. One of Walter's guru was Osho. The Bhagwan.
Of course.
I mean, we knew that when we came in the house, there was pictures of the Bhagwan up in the office and in a couple of other rooms. Walter went to great pains to make it perfectly clear that it was before he moved to Oregon. So he met him when he was still in India and the shift happened. We didn't talk about that. So that was something that didn't really come out. Yeah, you know, there's just so many things. There are so many things. At one point, one of the ideas that we had of, like, we wanted to see Walter, like, before the Miami event really kind of came to be, we were thinking of different ways of connecting Walter in person with his millennial audiences. Like, so the fact that the Miami event happened at the museum and that allowed him to be part of that naturally was great. But we wanted him to connect with millennial audiences. So one of the ideas we had is taking him to, like, a Comic-Con. Where I think he would have been in Puerto Rico, and that didn't happen. But I would have been fascinated to see how that would have unfurled. So that's one of the things that we talked about that didn't happen. Yeah, there's so many men. Yeah. I mean, so many moments with Walter that. But you know, the movie was 96 minutes, and we couldn't include everything.
Yeah. How long did you spend with Walter with the film, like shooting for the whole thing?
So the entire process from mm-hmm. our first production meeting to the launch on Netflix was 3 years. Wow. We shooting with Walter was just shy of 2 years.
Mm.
So we started in early 2018 and we finished shooting with him in late 2019. So a little under 2 years of actually shooting with him where we were going back and forth to Puerto Rico, every couple of months.
Yeah, I got the sense that you were with him for a while because you could kind of tell, you know, the scenes that were where he felt just like you were his, almost like family. Like you're in his house, whatever. Grab a seat, you know. Like he kind of let his, I could see him slowly let his guard down over the film, you know, in certain parts, which was really, I could really tell, you know, that he was just like comfortable with you guys completely.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, you know, that takes time. I think that's the biggest thing in a documentary is building that trust with your subject to kind of get the kind of film you want. And, you know, Walter was a, you know, notoriously very private person, had been in the media and in front of a camera for so many years. So building that trust was integral, but it, and that, that's simpatico, and that it took time. But we did. We became really close to Walter. I mean, not just to him, but to his family. Yeah. You know, so we always joke we now have this other family in Puerto Rico. And then, you know, we were with Walter 5 weeks before he passed away. Our producer Alex Fumero and I were pallbearers at his funeral.
Oh my God.
I mean, yeah, you know, it when you go into making a project like this, you're always told to kind of keep some distance between you and your subject, but it was pretty impossible in this case because, you know, you can't help but love Walter. His, you know, he is connected to our memories of family and abuelitas, and in a way, and him and his family are so lovely that you know that while it was always professional, let's just say it's really important to underscore mm-hmm. that because, you know, everything was very clear. There was agreements in place and everything. We navigated that space between professional and personal really, really well and became really, really close. And thank you. I do think that I'm glad that you say that you could see that in the film because it was certainly our hope that it would come across.
You know what the moment was for me was when I don't know if it was at like after the airport. It was some appearance that he was making and you all were with him and he was pushing a wheelchair and walking, and he told you, please don't shoot the wheelchair, just shoot me. And you just held the camera, you know, from the wheelchair up on him for that entire walk. And I don't know, any other documentary I would see, they would just pull away and show the whole scene, you know. But y'all made sure to respect his, you know, to respect his demands and just like be like, oh yeah, of course, we're just going to show what you want right now. But later, of course, you showed the wheelchair, but it was fine. He had given you permission. You could tell, you know. And I'm like, damn, such to treat the subject with such reverence and dignity, I think is so important because I feel like a lot of times we see all these films exploiting people, you know, for the gag, and this film is not about that, you know. And that's that moment, that very little specific moment said it all to me.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, we came to it with a great deal of admiration and appreciation for him.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we knew that we had to push him. And you know, when we set out to make the film, we were making this film about this icon from our childhood and, you know, telling his story of his unlikely rise to fame and his disappearance and, you know, mm-hmm. what happened. And what we didn't realize is we were also telling the film of making a film about aging and aging in front of the camera because Walter, you know, that we first met and who was like jumping on the floor with his little dog and up and down the stairs, you know, by the time the film was finished, he could not walk without assistance. Mm. And that's, you know, that's another kind of element in the film. And he was a person who was very, you know, had a strong sense of vanity. And so that was, you know, that was a challenge, but we insisted on also being like, we wanted to respect his wishes, but we also were trying to capture the truth of the moment. So it was difficult at some times when he would often be like, I only want to be shot from the waist up. Don't show the walker. Don't show mm-hmm. the wheelchair. And sometimes we would respect that. And other times we had to push him on it because mm-hmm. it was reality and we couldn't, you know, we couldn't allow.
Right.
You know, we couldn't allow a altered version of the truth to come across. So it was a balance that we had to strike. But I think we're, you know, I think we're certainly proud of the way we were able to share
And I think Walter would have hated seeing himself in the wheelchair.
Yeah.
But I think he would also have respected the decisions we made.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. What a wonderful film. Thank you for sharing it with the world. Y'all did an amazing job. And I just, I'm so excited to watch it with my grandma. I'm gonna get her a Netflix account so she can watch it.
You know, my grandma is 94 years old and lives by herself still, in a retirement community, the same one my mom lives in. They're like two buildings away from each other, but she still lives by herself. She doesn't have Netflix, and so she has not been able – she knows about the movie. She was able to see all of our TV appearances on Telemundo and in Univision, but she has not seen the movie. In fact, she's not ever seen any of my movies.
Oh my gosh.
I always say I have to find it. And she said, because it's only about half in Spanish, it's probably enough for her to understand, but I do have to she doesn't even have a DVD player, so I'm gonna have to find a way to burn a DVD after the pandemic and
dub it.
And when it's safe to see her and take it to her. But at the end of the film, Cristina Constantina, my co-director, and Alex Pumero, our producer, and I, we dedicate the film to our abuelitas and abuelitas everywhere, because I think that there's a strong abuelita vibe in that world for so many of us. And it's interesting how many people like yourself would say that, it made them remember their abuelas, or it made them want to call their abuelas, and I love that.
Well, Karim, we didn't even, I feel like we just scratched the surface, but I got to let you go. I've taken up so much of your time already. Thank you so much.
Love our chat. Thank you.
We didn't even get into Cinemas, your project. I'm going to put all these links in the show notes so you can see all of Karim's projects and all of his, everything that he's worked on, because there's just so much. But where can people find you on the internet?
I am on Instagram at Karim Tapsch, KareemTabsch, on Instagram and Twitter. So, find me there, and, www.kareemtapsch.com is my website. You can see The Last Resort and, Mucho Mucho Amor, The Legend of Walter Mercado. They're both on Netflix right now. Yes. And, Cherry Pop, Story of the World's Fanciest Cat, is on Amazon. And Dolphin Lover, which we barely even talked about Dolphin Lover, it's a crazy story, but there's obviously a lot to talk about in this wonderful chat, which I so enjoyed. But you can see Dolphin Lover on YouTube, and have a little glass of wine and watch Dolphin Lover, and it will make for an interesting conversation.
Karim, have you been to Vegas?
I have to tell you that I have never spent more than an hour through the airport. I have actually never properly visited Vegas. And all of my friends always say they can't believe that. They're like, you would love Las Vegas. How have you never been there? And I'm like, okay. It's never happened.
I'm going to say it right now, and I'm going to say it on air so that I can't take it back. But if you ever come to Las Vegas, I would love to give you a personal tour of all of my favorite things, because I'm into the kitsch. I'm into the weird. I'm into Liberace, so I will take you to all the places. And everything relates to Vegas, which is, I think there's a connection between South Florida and Las Vegas for sure. There's a dolphin habitat at one of the casinos here. And I even related to the Dolphin Lover documentary, because I think the Duchess is the oldest dolphin at the Mirage at the dolphin habitat. And she's over 40 now at this point. And she reminded me of Dolly, was her name in the documentary. And I'm like, this guy, he's got to come to Vegas. I got to show him the dolphin habitat.
Girl, I would love that. Let me just say that. I would A, love that, and B, 100% take you up on it. I want to see the strip is going to be fun, I'm sure. But I want to see the weird things that the true Las Vegas. What is it? Las Vegasite? I don't know. What do you call yourself?
Las Vegan.
Las Vegan that you would love. And I think we probably have I think it's very clear we have some similar sensibilities here.
Yeah.
So I'm going to take you up on that tour whenever we can travel again and
yes.
leave my house.
Yes. Well, thank you for your time. And I hope to meet you someday. And I look so forward to watching your future projects.
Thank you so much, Justin. I look forward to it as well, meeting you in person and staying in touch. This is my cell that I called you on.
Okay.
Keep in touch, and I'll see you.
Subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like what you've heard, please make sure you rate and review the show. You can follow us on social media at Art People Pod. Today's episode was produced and edited by me, Justin Favela, with production assistance from Mindy Hale. Music by Mike McDonald. Send me your emails. If you have any questions or you want some advice, please send your emails to artpeoplepod@gmail.com, and I might read them on a future episode. Okay, bye.